From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
My speech here is an appeal to all humanity, to all the people who lost a dear one. You know the experience. Look what happened to us. Look what the U.S. policy did to us. Look what the American dream and how it was implemented here. We lost our happiness. We lost our lives. We lost our liberty.
Today, an interview with Dima Tavoub, her husband, Tariq Ayoub, journalist with Al Jazeera, killed when U.S. forces bombed his office in Baghdad. But first, filmmaker John Alpert and Democracy Now! Producer Sharif Abdel Qaddous, who just returned from Baghdad. We'll hear their report.
We did a story about what happened to sports people in Iraq, both under the previous regime with stories that, you know, I don't have a lot of hair anymore, made my hair stand on end, and the things they're suffering with right now.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Indonesia's military chief today ordered his men to exterminate Aceh separatist guerrillas who refused to surrender. General Endriartono Sutarto told around 400 officers in a briefing, quote, hunt them down and exterminate them. Sutarto also ordered troops to spare civilians, warning them, quote, what you are doing here now is being broadcast all over the world. He told the officers, if there are soldiers who do violate the order and cause suffering to people in the field, then just shoot them in the head. Sutarto's comments come as the huge offensive in the oil-rich province enters its second day. It appears the Indonesian military learned a tactic from the Pentagon. The Guardian of London reports dozens of journalists have been embedded with military units, and television viewers are able to view the parachute drop and several skirmishes. Some 5,000 poorly armed guerrillas are facing nearly 30,000 Indonesian troops in Aceh. Human Rights Watch said during the decade-long operation launched in Aceh in 1989, thousands of civilians were murdered, disappeared, or tortured. A rebel spokesperson told The Guardian a couple of dozen civilians have already been killed, beaten, or kidnapped. He said it's going to be genocide all over again. An Aceh education officer told Agence France-Presse some 180 schools are in flames. The attack on Aceh is Indonesia's largest military operation since the 1975 invasion of East Timor. Meanwhile, East Timor celebrated its first anniversary as an independent country today. Some 10,000 Timorese gathered in front of the government palace in the capital of Dili. East Timor's flag was raised and a minute of silence was held for national heroes killed in the struggle for independence. President Xanana Gusmao addressed the crowd and spoke of East Timor's struggles with poverty. He said there is no prospect for employment of the country's youth and accused parliament of wasting time. This news from Israel. A suicide bomber killed two people outside a shopping mall north of Jenin yesterday, marking the fifth such attack since Saturday. Two groups, Islamic Jihad and Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, claimed responsibility. The wave of attacks is widely assumed to be an attempt to disrupt the negotiations between Israel and Palestinian leaders over the U.S.-sponsored roadmap to peace. In related news, the United Nations and aid agencies protested Israel's attempt to close off Gaza to everyone from entering or leaving except diplomats and journalists. Oxfam, Doctors Without Borders, and the World Food Program said the move was preventing aid from reaching Gaza and that it was in violation of international law. And two Palestinian journalists, one of whom works for French public television, said today they'd been beaten up by Israeli soldiers in the West Bank town of Bethlehem. This according to Agence France-Presse. In a meeting with Philippines President Arroyo, President Bush announced yesterday the U.S. would increase its aid to the Philippines in its fight in the so-called war on terror. The U.S. is expected to supply $95 million and an estimated 700 troops. The Washington Post reports under the agreement, the U.S. will provide substantial training assistance to Philippine units engaged in combat operations against the Abu Sayyaf group. United Nations officials are investigating the killing of two UN observers in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The two UN observers, a Nigerian and a Jordanian, were part of a UN team of military observers sent to monitor ceasefire agreements aimed at ending the Congo War. Their bodies were exhumed from a makeshift grave this weekend near the gold mining town of Mongbualu. The UN Security Council has approved the deployment of an international force to stop escalating bloodshed in the northeastern part of the Congo, where 50,000 people have died. The fighting has been exacerbated by regional competition for control of gold and other resources. The London Observer is reporting U.S. soldiers have vandalized the Sumerian city of Ur in southern Iraq, which may be the world's most ancient structure. Aid workers have said U.S. forces spray-painted the remains with graffiti and stole kiln-baked bricks made millennia ago. As a result, the U.S. military has put the archaeological treasure, which dates back 6,000 years, off limits to its own troops. Ur is believed by many to be the birthplace of the prophet Abraham. It was the religious seat of civilization of Sumer, which ruled Mesopotamia starting about 4000 BC. It was there that the wheel was invented, the first mathematical system developed, and the first poetry written. 59 gang members who were killed in a Honduras prison were the victims of a police massacre. This according to an independent report commissioned by the Honduran president. The police initially reported the prisoners died after setting a suicidal fire at the jail. The report says 51 of the dead were shot, stabbed, beaten, or burned to death by a force of state police, soldiers, prison guards, and prisoners working with the guards. According to the New York Times, the victims were members of a youth gang called the Mara 18, an offshoot of the Los Angeles-based 18th Street Gang. The report reveals the wretched state of Honduras's prisons. On the day of the massacre, the prison El Porvenir held close to 550 men, 350 more than its capacity. A police sergeant at the prison said the arrival of 80 gang members in February turned the prison into a time bomb. Supreme Court has upheld a Maine drug cost program that penalizes pharmaceutical companies that refuse to provide affordable prescription drugs to poor citizens. The 6-3 ruling may have important implications for the increasing number of Americans whose health care is threatened by the rising cost of prescription drugs. They are either not poor enough to qualify for Medicaid or are covered by private plans that do not cover many prescriptions. Several other states are expected to take the ruling as a go-ahead to adopt similar prescription drug programs. A new report by the Congressional Research Service has determined that U.S. gun laws can be easily exploited by international terror groups who can obtain assault-style firearms or explosives by taking advantage of delays and loopholes in the federal gun control system. This according to a report in the Washington Post. Democratic Senator Frank Lautenberg lashed out at the Bush administration for failing to strengthen gun control laws after September 11th. Lautenberg said after 9/11, Americans stood in long lines at airports giving up their toenail clippers, while the Bush administration has done nothing to prevent terrorists from acquiring military-style weapons and explosives. If we're serious about shoring up homeland security, he said, we cannot ignore this any longer. This news from Florida. A man who drove his truck into a mosque and yelled anti-Muslim threats has been sentenced to more than 2 years in prison. The man, Charles Franklin, pled guilty to hate crimes in November. He could have been sentenced to up to 20 years in prison. Instead, he received the minimum sentence. At St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, 1 in 8 graduates walked out of a commencement speech by Senator Rick Santorum to protest his remarks condemning homosexuality. Santorum, the Senate's third-ranking Republican, has refused to apologize for remarks he made last month comparing homosexuality to incest, bigamy, polygamy, and adultery. The Pentagon is developing a radar-based device that can identify people by the way they walk. for use in a massive surveillance program. This according to a report by the Associated Press. The Georgia Institute of Technology says it has created a system that is 80 to 95% successful in identifying people by their gait. AP reports the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, could use the ID system to be part of a vast surveillance system alongside databases containing financial, education, medical, and housing records, as well as biometric identification databases based on fingerprints, irises, and facial shapes. Well, if they don't get you walking, they'll get you sitting. The Daily News in New York is reporting that New York police have ticketed a 19-year-old man in the Bronx for simply sitting on a milk crate. The man, Jesse Tavares, was given a ticket Sunday that read, quote, unauthorized use of a milk crate. He was sitting in front of a hair braiding salon in the Bronx where he works. Police approached him. He was asked for ID and then checked if he had any outstanding warrants. He did not. Then he was issued the summons. The police officer told him why, quote, because you're sitting. We have to make our daily quota. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, 14 Black Paintings by Peter Gabriel. Music. I'm Amy Goodman. Some 50 electrical workers staged a demonstration outside the headquarters of U.S.-British coalition forces in a former presidential palace in Baghdad. They were protesting against the appointment of a former Ba'ath Party official as director of the electricity department. The electricity department workers handed over a letter to U.S. forces. Agence France-Presse reports the letter says, quote, we were shocked and horrified to see the same old guard come back. It says, we ask you to hear our appeals to help and to sack the clique of corrupt hypocrites. It reads, do not let the excuse of restoring electric power prevent you from carrying out your sacred duty to make Iraq a free country. The demonstration comes just a day after some 10,000 Shiite Muslims rallied peacefully in front of a Sunni mosque in Baghdad. They demanded the U.S. hand over power to the Iraqi people and withdraw its troops from the country. The Shiite protest comes after the new U.S. ruler of Iraq, Paul Bremer, announced the U.S. has indefinitely put off plans for Iraqi self-rule. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reports Iraqis have begun tracking down and killing former members of the Ba'ath Party. The assassinations appear to have picked up since the U.S. issued a decree last Friday that prohibits senior Ba'ath Party officials from holding positions in Iraq's post-war government. The Post reports former exile groups and Iraqis familiar with some of the killings say the number of Ba'ath Party members assassinated since the invasion could reach several hundred in Baghdad alone. Well, we're joined right now in the studio by filmmaker John Alpert. He is founder of Downtown Community Television, which is where Democracy Now! Is based, here at the Firehouse in Chinatown. We're also joined by Democracy Now! Producer Sharif Abdelkaddous. They have both just returned from Baghdad, there to set up a dialogue by satellite between Iraqi youth in Baghdad and American youth in New York. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! And Sharif, it's nice to have you in the chair over there.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You also have produced a documentary that's going to air on HBO tonight. John, why don't you talk about that?
This is a documentary about sports in Iraq. What happened to sports people before the war under Saddam and particularly his son Uday? What's happened to them during the war, and what the future of sports is going to be. And we're using this as a metaphor for looking at Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find? Who are the soccer players of Iraq?
Well, the soccer players of Iraq really, really suffered. Uday Saddam's son decided that he wanted to be in charge of sports. It seems he had a number of reasons. He just liked power. He wanted to be at the center of power, and especially soccer in Iraq, everybody loves it, and they worship the players. And I think he wanted to bask in some of their glory. He also was a control freak, and I think also he was a psychopath. And he took over soccer, and the lives of the players became hell. He would, for example, coach the teams when he wasn't supposed to. So at halftime, he would go into the locker room and he would lecture the players. If the players missed a penalty kick or the ball came in and they missed a head or something like that, he would punish them. There's one astonishing story. The team went to the Olympics. They were playing Italy, and Uday demanded that the team beat Italy. Now, Italy's one of the top soccer powers in the world. Iraq made a pretty good show, but they lost. When the plane arrived back at the airport, Uday and his thugs were waiting, and they took the entire team to jail, and they tortured the team for 3 days. Uday built a special jail in the Olympic Committee offices in the basement, 30 cells, where he would take players and he would torture them, sometimes for mistakes on the field, but sometimes he just didn't like them and he tortured them, and the things he did to these players were unbelievable.
Nice.
He took... there's one player, Habib Jafar. He always was after this guy. He took him to a presidential palace, held him there for 14 days, actually with most of the team in a little tiny room about the size of this table. The guys didn't even have any room to sleep. They would get them up at dawn. They would run them. They would whip them. They would beat them until their backs were raw and oozing. And then at the end of the day, they would march them to a tower 90 feet high. They'd climb up the tower and make them dive down into a vat of raw sewage. Now, I heard all these stories. Some you hear stories like this from afar, and you think, oh, this is just propaganda. This is anti-Saddam stuff. It's not. All the players had stories like this, and it was absolutely horrifying. And I love sports. I like to play sports. I'm no good at it, but I always try. And even when I was a little kid, I had dreams. I was going to be a pitcher. I was going to be a hockey player. The same for kids in Iraq, but their dreams turned into horrible, horrible nightmares because Uday tortured these players for years, and they are thrilled to death to see this guy out of there.
What, you have a clip for us that you wanted to play?
Well, they're thrilled to death to get him out of there, but... like in the case of many Iraqis, sometimes got messy. The most famous athlete in Iraq is a man named Amu Baba. He is the equivalent of Michael Jordan, Mickey Mantle, Vince Lombardi, all rolled into one. The greatest coach, the greatest player in the history of Iraq. Uday tortured him, made his family suffer, but Amu Baba also suffered during the war because his family and his house became collateral damage, and that's what this clip is about.
Amu Baba thought his troubles would be over. Unfortunately, his house and his family became what is called collateral damage.
This was bombarded by American airplanes, so I think they missed the target, you know. They hit my house and my neighbor's house. It was killed from my house, my relative, brother-in-law, and two sons.
Amu Baba wasn't the only sportsman who suffered. The war destroyed the entire Iraqi sports infrastructure.
Yes. And that a clip from the piece that you're doing on the soccer team of Iraq for HBO that's airing tonight.
Right. It's going to be on Real Sports tonight at 10 o'clock Eastern and Pacific and 9 o'clock Central. So pay up your HBO. It's about $4 a month. The money that you're not sending to public radio if you've got any left around just for this month.
Sharif, can you talk about your experiences there? It was your first time in Iraq. You went after the invasion at a time of increasing anarchy and chaos.
I think in my first reports from over there, I explained that you may get a false sense of security walking around Baghdad. At least I think I did. You know, you walk around, it seems like a third world country. There's garbage on the streets, people milling around, but then all of a sudden there can be at any moment an attack, just looters or burglars. There is no consequence to anyone's actions. And I think I compared it to, imagine a city just with no police, the anarchy that would take place after that. So it was a very interesting experience to be there. There was a conflict between most of the Iraqis that I spoke with, happiness at, you know, being rid of the Saddam regime, but bitterness at the U.S. military occupation. And Craig Renault, who was part of the team with us, had a very interesting conversation with the soldier. The soldier told him, you know, we're not the right soldiers to be here, to be protecting the Iraqi people. We had to fight our way in from Iraq. We're trained or we're used to retaliating with force towards them. He said we should be sent home and a new force should be sent there. So I think it's important to realize that the military occupation right now, this is not a force that's trained in policing people. It's not a peacekeeping force. And they're not trained in occupation. They're trained in war, which may be difficult later on. You know, the situation may boil over. I'm not sure. What we have to remember is it's the first time the U.S. occupies a country in the Middle East, and they have no experience at it. Or so, you know, when we drove up to the border, you can kind of cross the Amman border, and they let us through. Then there's kind of a 200-yard no man's land, and then there's, you know, the U.S. soldier standing at the Iraqi border, and it's a very potent image, very stark image to see a soldier, you know, patrolling a border in the Middle East.
John, you have been to Iraq a number of times. You were there right before the invasion. You were there during the Persian Gulf War. What are your observations over these different times?
Well, the people in Iraq have been really suffering, and their suffering hasn't stopped. In the case of sports people, the entire infrastructure of sports in Iraq has been destroyed. I mean, Uday did a pretty good job making the players miserable, but the war destroyed everything else. The United States bombed the Olympic headquarters, perhaps looking for Uday. But then the looters got loose, and they stripped clear absolutely every sports facility in the country. You don't find a boxing glove. You can't find a soccer ball. They stole the toilets. They stole the showers. They stole absolutely everything. And the people are starting from zero. There's no records about sports. Who's the fastest person in Iraq? Who's the boxing champion? You could be the boxing champion of Iraq. I mean, nobody knows because there's no records anymore. There's no security. The people are begging for security. People are afraid to leave their houses. You can't go to the corner store, especially if you're a woman. There's danger of kidnapping. And the people want security. I think they're a little bit conflicted. I think they would like to have their own security, but they want security right now because it's dangerous. We had one car of ours carjacked, and then we observed a second car right in front of us pulled up to the intersection. Four guys come running out from the corners with guns. Boom, 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 boom. Killed the guy in the car to steal his car.
Were they doing it to steal his car or to assassinate him?
This was a car theft. It's a situation in which the people feel so insecure. A couple of them, not many, a couple of them say, gee, at least under Saddam I was safe. He was the devil that they knew. This situation of anarchy is the devil they don't know. We had a lot of interaction with U.S. troops, more interaction than I've ever had in my history. And I expected the troops were going to be difficult for us to work with and sort of rude to the Iraqi people. They weren't. In general, they were very, very polite. They were trying to do their job, but they are absolutely overwhelmed. They cannot patrol a city of that size. They don't have the resources. They don't have the experience. They don't have the contacts. And as a result, you go out at night after 8 o'clock, your life is not worth the plug nickel. And you sit around in the hotel room, and all night long you hear boom, 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 boom. And this is not the American troops going after Saddam's folks. This is violence in the streets, and it's out of control.
Mm-hmm. What about now the news we have of Iraqi self-rule being put off, the protests, tens of thousands of people, Shiite, joining together with others who have traditionally not been allies at this time of occupied Iraq, Sharif?
Well, I think that you know, as John was explaining, the main thing that people are demanding now is security. And to have kind of this stalemate at the moment where people aren't sure what's going on, whether, well, as you just said, you know, protests are increasing. You know, I fear that things may turn violent eventually if the situation does not improve. But one thing actually that John brought up in a conversation, which I thought was very interesting, if the U.S. had, say, for example, as soon as they had invaded Iraq and, you know, the looters came out and the U.S. had subdued them, the military had subdued them, had stopped them straight away, mass arrests, possibly, I'm sure some people may have been shot, you know, to protect the museum, the library and so forth, there would have been international outrage, and rightly so. But now, you know, many Iraqis are demanding that the U.S. provide control, that provide security. Many of the ones I've spoken to said, you know, they are the government now. They came in, but they are the government. They're responsible, so they should provide control. We saw scenes of, you know, looters being caught by American military, and you know, the military was kicking this one guy who was on the ground, a looter who was tied up, and the crowd was cheering. They were cheering them on. So, you know, this may be a thought-out strategy by the U.S. military to wait until, you know, the public demands that they provide security, and then they can do it under that, you know, kind of defense.
Another reason you were there was to do your second bridge to Baghdad. You did one before, and we played an excerpt of that, of young people in Baghdad, young people in New York speaking to each other. Were you able to find the young people who had spoken before? Were you able to regather them to have the conversation?
We found 6 of the 7 kids. One we couldn't find. It's hard to find people in Baghdad. The phones don't work. So you have to hunt. And one person, we had never visited their home, so we did not succeed in finding her. The phones work in a small concentric circle. So if we wanted to call you, if we got somewhere near your house, maybe a half a mile from your house, we have a chance of calling you within that particular exchange, but you can't call from one part of the city to the other. So this was a little bit of an Easter egg hunt, but we did manage to find the kids, and actually some of them are working for the American media. They speak good English, and they're working for CNN as translators and fixers. The thing that was our initial shock is we wanted to go back to the scene of the dialogue. We held this at a community center similar to this community center here in New York. It was community center to community center. And as we drove up to this community center, this really nasty-looking guy with a machine gun came running out and sort of pointed his machine gun at us. I said, well, that's a nice welcome. I wonder what's going on here. And it turns out that Ahmed Chalabi, is that how we're pronouncing his name? the gentleman who the United States was initially sort of pushing forward as the new leader of Iraq, his guys had decided to steal this community center. They took it over. They just expropriated it. And anybody who comes up who they think might want to get this thing back and put it back to community use, they threaten with guns. No compensation for the people that were there before. They just took it away. And that's what's going on in Iraq. There is a lot of, I'm tougher than you, this house is mine now, this car is mine now, and it happened to this community center, the only one in Iraq, and it's gone.
And the kids, they reengaged, they had their discussion?
It was a terrific discussion, because we did our best to sort of outfox the Iraqi censors before, to get around the Bureau of the Ministry of Information, preoccupy the babysitter so the kids could talk candidly, but they couldn't talk candidly, but they can talk candidly now. And it was a much more open exchange with their American counterparts, but also following the daily lives of these kids and seeing what Iraqi youth are going through, you got a really good understanding of what's happening in Iraq right now.
And some of the young people, Sharif, are starting their own media center or newspaper in Baghdad.
Yeah, one of the kids I spoke with, Walid, it's one of the six Iraqi kids, him and another one, Hamza and Haider. They are starting the first independent newspaper in Iraq by Iraqis for Iraqis. They're being helped by Ramzi Qaisi from Voices of the Wilderness. Spoke with him at length about the newspaper. It's called Al Muwajjaha, which it means the warrior or the protector, the guardian. And they are basically trying to get, you know, any reports, opinions, any articles from Iraqis. It's going to be published in both English and Arabic. And I think their first edition may have already come out this Wednesday. But it seems like a very interesting venture, you know, it's by people who have just, especially that it's a young contributing writers who are contributing to the paper. They have some very interesting opinions. It's in a very, very tumultuous time. And hopefully we can get Ramzi on the show at some point to speak about it.
Do they have equipment, like computers?
He showed me his office, his equipment. It's one laptop in the hotel lobby that he sits on. So, you know, they obviously don't have much funding or anything like that, but they seem to be very dedicated, and they're moving forward with it. So hopefully we'll get to see a first edition soon.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Sharif Abdelkaddous, producer of Democracy Now!, just returned from Baghdad with John Alpert, the founder of Downtown Community Television here in Chinatown, which trains people in the community how to use video and document their communities. A longtime filmmaker, Emmy Award-winning journalist who has been documenting what's been going on in Iraq for over a decade, and been blacklisted from the networks for his efforts, and also occasionally they play your stuff.
That's right. Tonight on HBO, of all places, Real Sports. And what did you think of Sharif's camera work? He did pretty well, didn't he?
Great job, Sharif.
Yeah, thank you.
We look forward to having you back on and playing excerpts of The Bridge to Baghdad, the conversation between the young people of New York and Baghdad. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll speak with the wife, the widow of Tariq Ayoob, the Al Jazeera reporter who was killed when the U.S. military shelled the Al Jazeera offices in Baghdad. And then Haider, an Iraqi woman whose son was killed in 1999 under U.S. bombs in Iraq. He was 6 years old. Stay with us.
Devil. از بر رفیقان وطن دل بیقراره، از بر رفیقان وطن دل بیقراره.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. An anonymous advisor to the Prime Minister of Belgium told the Agence France-Presse the Belgian government will block a lawsuit there against the U.S. commander of the U.S. forces for alleged war crimes. 17 Iraqis and 2 Jordanians filed a suit against General Tommy Franks. The lawsuit accuses U.S. troops of using cluster bombs in civilian areas and firing on ambulances in 3 separate incidents. The lawsuit is brought under a law in Belgium called the Universal Competence Law. It allows charges to be brought regardless of where the alleged crimes took place. But under U.S. pressure, Belgian lawmakers in early April amended the law, enabling federal prosecutors to decide whether a suit can proceed. The anonymous advisor told the Agence France-Presse the prime minister will call a special cabinet session this week to apply the amended law and stop the lawsuit. The AFP earlier reported that the Jordanian plaintiffs are the widow and father of Tariq Ayub. On April 8th, U.S. forces bombed the Baghdad offices of Al Jazeera, killing the Al Jazeera correspondent inside, Tariq Ayub. Moments later, and less than a mile away, another explosion damaged the offices of Abu Dhabi TV, trapping as many 30 journalists in the debris. And then a U.S. tank fired on the Palestine Hotel, where almost all the unembedded international reporters were staying. A Ukrainian cameraman with Reuters news agency Taras Prostyuk was killed, as was Jose Cuso, who worked for Telecinco Spanish television. That evening, Al Jazeera broadcast an interview with the widow of Tariq Ayub, Dima Taboub. Tears streamed down her face as she said, "American forces, British forces are in a war that was claimed to be clean. I cannot see the cleanness in this war. What I see is blood, destruction, and shattered hearts." She said, "The Americans said it was a war against terrorism. Who is doing the terrorism now?" We're joined right now by Dima Taboub from her home in Jordan. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much, Mom.
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's April 8th, the date that you lost your husband, that he was killed. Can you tell us about the circumstances that you've learned since then, about exactly what happened?
We know that Al Jazeera office was targeted by a rocket, and that my husband was killed at that time. We received the news like other viewers from Al Jazeera satellite channel.
You said that the office was targeted by a rocket?
Yeah. Mm. No, it was targeted by American.
Uh-huh.
And we knew after that it was intentional, because Al Jazeera office, before the war started in Baghdad, they gave them the location of the office in Baghdad. So it was not a mistake, it was intentional. That's what the manager of the Al Jazeera satellite channel told me, and they had the map there for the exact location for Al Jazeera office. So it's not a mistake, as the U.S. Army claimed.
Have you spoken with the U.S. government?
There's nothing to speak about. I saw their actions, which were aggressive and were bloody. I can feel what they did. There's no need to speak to them. I can feel that. I can feel it by the sorrow that I feel every day. I can feel it through the tears of my mother-in-law. I can feel it. I can feel it from my daughter, who's going looking through all the rooms of the house looking for her father, who keeps holding his picture and giving him kisses. I can feel what they did, and this is more expressive than whatever they have to say.
This wasn't the first time that Al Jazeera offices were bombed by the U.S. military. In Afghanistan, in Kabul, the same thing happened. You said that Al Jazeera had given the coordinates of the office to the Pentagon?
Yes.
And what did the Pentagon say?
This was clearly stated in a press conference by Al Jazeera manager.
And what?
After the death of my husband,
And while you haven't spoken to the U.S. military, has Al Jazeera spoken to the military or U.S. government?
I don't know of any correspondence between them. But what's the use? What they have done, and we're living it now, and we're paying for what they have done. I want Tommy Franks to come and look my daughter in the eyes and tell her, dear, it was a mistake that you're going to pay for it through all your life. I want him to look my mother-in-law in the eyes, who is vomiting blood at least two times a day. I want Vincent Brooks to come and tell her it was a mistake. I want him to come and tell me when the only way for me to sleep is to cry myself to sleep. I want him to come and tell me that this was a mistake.
Can you tell us about your husband, Tariq Ayoub, the journalist for Al Jazeera? When had he gotten to Baghdad?
He arrived in Baghdad on Saturday, 3 days before he was killed. He was a very dedicated person to his job. He was a very loyal husband. He was a very passionate father. He was loved by all his friends. He was loved by his family. He was a great loss to us. We are barely living now. I don't have anything to live for right now after the loss of my husband. The only thing that I have to live for is to raise my child. I'm very sorry to say that, never to forgive or to forget. I've always learned. I'm a BA English graduate. I've always learned when I used to study the American literature that the American dream that the U.S. is trying to implement here is that of life, happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But what I saw really on the ground is the loss of life, the loss of happiness, and the loss of the means to pursue this happiness. The U.S. liberty came to us with a tanker, which is synonymous in our mind to an Israeli tanker, which is killing our fellow Palestinians in the West Bank. This is what we know of the American freedom. This is what we know. We have seen the American freedom. In the cluster bombs, we have seen them in the hellfire rockets. We have seen them in the cholera that spread in Basra after the U.S. military cut the water resources there. I've seen them in the eyes of the orphans. I've seen them in the eyes of my daughter. I've seen them in the widows of Iraq. My husband did not go there armed. He was armed with only one thing, his intention and his determination to reveal the truth. This was the only thing that he was armed with, and the U.S. wanted to even to prevent him from the right even to reveal a picture. He was not saying his side of the story or what he believed in. He was only saying, just look and determine for yourself. And even the U.S. wanted to conceal that.
The lawsuit that you have filed, or that a number of Iraqis have filed in the Belgian court, do you think it will move ahead?
Well, I don't have a comment regarding this lawsuit in particular, but I'm not very optimistic because I know about the American dominance everywhere. I know about the American threats. I've heard, like other viewers and other audience, about the threats to Belgium. And I'm not very optimistic because I believe that unless you are an American citizen, you don't have the right to live or you don't have the right to exist. There was a joke that was circulated around the net weeks ago that it says as follows. The UN launched a survey in the United States about the rest of the world. The feedback was a big failure because in the United States they didn't know what the rest of the world meant. And this is really what I believe. Unless you're an American, you don't have the right to live. You don't have the right even to ask for what you write, for a compensation for what you have lost. If there is one.
The response of the U.S. media to the killing of journalists in Iraq by the U.S. forces has been markedly different than the response in other places. Your husband died on April 8th, right about the same time that the U.S. forces shelled the Palestine Hotel where Taras Prostyuk died, the Ukrainian cameraman, and Jose Cuso, the cameraman who worked for Telecinco Spanish television. In Spain, the journalists, the media workers, the elite journalists, hundreds of them protested. There were two Spanish journalists who were killed. They went to Parliament. They laid down their cameras, their pens, their pencils, their cables, and they turned their backs on the prime minister. And then they went outside to the U.S. embassy, and they blocked the intersection. This was hundreds of media workers and journalists, and they shouted, "Murderer, murderer." A very different response in the U.S. To what happened to one journalist after another in Iraq. What has been the response of the Jordanian government?
It was they sent us their condolences. And they were. This is what I heard at least, because now we're in a period of mourning. We're not very in touch with them. I called on anybody who believes in humanity to launch a suit against the American forces for what they did to my husband, but I didn't have any responses till now, because I think principally, everyone is afraid to do anything because of the American dictations, because of the American accusations to any person, because of the American implications, because look what happened in Belgium. They threatened Belgium not to hold any NATO meetings there. So what do you expect from us here in the Arab world?
Any last words for those who are listening and watching? Dima Taboub, widow of Tariq Ayoub, the Al Jazeera reporter, Palestinian-Jordanian reporter who died in his office in Baghdad when the U.S. military shelled his office.
What I meant by speech here, it may seem very passionate, but it's an appeal for humanity. It's an appeal for all those who lost a dear one. It's an appeal for all those who believe that still humanity has its place, we still have the right to live, to stop all the American atrocities everywhere. Maybe I don't know why this war started. I know what was the effect of this war on me personally. I lost my life because of the loss of my husband. I cannot see the advantage of this war. I cannot see where the American freedom falls within this war. What I see is a black picture of the future, a person who's not going to turn the other cheek. As I said, I'm living only for not to forgive or forget. And as the Old Testament says, an eye for an eye.
Dima Taboub, I want to thank you for being with us, the widow of Tariq Ayoub. When you say an eye for an eye, what do you mean?
I have a child to raise, as I said. I'm going to raise her, to ask for what's her right, to ask to be compensated if there is a compensation for the loss and for being deprived from her father.
Dima Taboub is speaking to us from Amman, Jordan. When we come back from our break, we'll be speaking with an Iraqi mother who's now in Southern California with her 9-year-old boy, her surviving son, from an earlier bombing under the Clinton administration during the imposition of the no-fly zones. And she'll talk about what happened with one son and how her surviving son is faring. Stay with us. Thank you. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, as we talk about casualties of war. I'm Amy Goodman. A 9-year-old boy who was wounded in the 1999 U.S. bombing of Iraq is now in Southern California with his mother, Haider. His name is Mustafa. Groups like Voices in the Wilderness fought hard to get him a visa to get out of Iraq so that he could be treated here. His brother was killed in the bombing that so severely wounded him. Haider, his mother, joins us on the phone right now from Los Angeles. Welcome to Democracy Now! Haider, can you hear me?
Yeah.
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us first about the bombing and then why you're here?
Of course I'm here because to help my brother, my son Mustafa, to get his treatment, medical treatment. As you know, on 1999, the 25th of January, an American missile fell down on our area and damaged 65 houses and 67 people injured, and 4 children were killed at that bombing. And because of the helping of the good American people, the Voices of the Wilderness, we are here.
Haider, your son that died, where was he on the day that the bombs fell?
He was 6 years old, and he was 3 girls, another girl, were dead and bombing.
And was Mustafa, his brother, with him?
Yeah, of course. Mustafa was the most dangerous one in this bombing. He lived by, he get his live by a miracle from the God, because we, the doctor thought that he will die, but God helped me and maybe listen to me and to listen to my sadness and make him live again.
He lost several fingers in the bombing?
Yeah.
And trapped?
Yeah. He lost 2 fingers from his left hand, and he, at the same time, he, a piece of missile settled in his liver from from his bag by and settled, the piece of missile settled in his liver and damaged a part of it. And the Iraqi doctors treat him in very, very good way. They cut the damaged part, and all of his body till now full of pieces of missiles. Some of them are big size, have big size. Others are small.
Who is treating him now in Los Angeles?
many doctors treating him. Even he has psychological doctors treat him now.
Among the people who helped bring you to the United States, get you a visa, help you get treatment for your son, Mustafa,
yeah,
is the screenwriter Cole Miller, who put Mustafa's photo on his website, nomorevictims.org. Yeah. How did he learn about your son?
How did he learn?
Yes.
Yeah, because of they make connection between No More Victims and Voices. And they are very, very good people, kind people. They always helped the Iraqi people, especially in Basra. They helped them always.
What are your plans for the future, Haider? You're in Los Angeles now. You're in the United States. Will you stay here or go back to Iraq?
I'm waiting Mustafa's condition. If he needs more more attention or more treatment, we will stay and finish this. Maybe you can stay here, if we can.
Will you be traveling to New York? I understood you were coming to talk to people at the United Nations, but then that trip was canceled.
Yeah. And they canceled it because I didn't know why. They said because it's she's an Iraqi woman. I heard this. I don't know why.
And your thoughts now about the occupation of Iraq, the invasion, the removal of Saddam Hussein?
Yeah. We needed that the leaving of Saddam Hussein, but we didn't need it in this way. The Iraqi people or the Iraqi were destroyed completely. I feel very, very sorry about them because the Iraqi people are very, very good people. They didn't deserve these things. And they tried from 90 till now, you know, as you know, 13 years of sanctions. And before the sanction, a war, and now a war. And everything is destroyed in Iraq.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Haider.
Thank you for you.
Haider, her son Mustafa being treated in a Los Angeles hospital from wounds he suffered in a bombing by the U.S. in 1999 in Iraq. Her other son, Haider, was killed in that attack. That does it for the show. If you'd like to get a cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Sharif Abdel-Kaddous, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Rybel, Vilka Tsouras. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, with help from Rich Kim. Our website, democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. Our email address, mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for watching and listening. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I think one way we can see that the embedded reporter system didn't serve us as citizens is that, to a person, all of the military people loved it. Tommy Franks praised it. General Brooks praised it. George Bush, everybody's been praising it. And if the military praises a system by which information is distributed, it seems to me that's a pretty good indication it was the information being distributed that they wanted.
The Pentagon propaganda and the corporate media. How do they function in a time of war? We'll hear from journalism professor Robert Jensen. But first, the FCC is poised to allow the largest wave of media consolidation in U.S. history. We'll have a debate. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Indonesia's military chief today ordered his men to exterminate Aceh's separatist guerrillas who refused to surrender. The general, Andre Artono Suharto, told 400 officers in a briefing, quote, hunt them down and exterminate them. Suharto also ordered troops to spare civilians, warning them, quote, What you're doing here is now being broadcast around the world. He told the officers, if there are soldiers who violate the order and cause suffering to people in the field, then just shoot them in the head. Suharto's comments come as the huge offensive in the oil-rich province enters its second day. It appears the Indonesian military learned a tactic from the Pentagon. The Guardian of London reports dozens of journalists have been embedded with military units, and television viewers are now able to view the parachute drop and several skirmishes in Aceh. Some 5,000 poorly armed guerrillas are facing nearly 30,000 Indonesian troops. Human Rights Watch said during the decade-long operation launched in Aceh, thousands of civilians were murdered, disappeared, and tortured by the Indonesian military. A rebel spokesperson told The Guardian that several dozen civilians have already been killed, beaten, or kidnapped. He said, quote, it's going to be genocide all over again. An Aceh education officer told the Agence France-Presse some 180 schools are in flames. The attack on Aceh is Indonesia's largest military operation since the 1975 invasion of East Timor. Meanwhile, East Timor celebrated its first anniversary today as an independent country. Some 10,000 Timorese gathered in front of the government palace in the capital, Dili. East Timor's flag was raised and a minute of silence was held for national heroes killed in the struggle for independence. The Indonesian military wiped out a third of the population of East Timor during its nearly quarter of a century occupation. This news from Israel. A suicide bomber killed three people outside a shopping mall north of Jenin yesterday, marking the fifth such attack since Saturday. Two groups, Islamic Jihad and Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, have claimed responsibility. The wave of attacks is widely assumed to be an attempt to disrupt the negotiations between Israel and Palestinian leaders over the U.S.-sponsored roadmap to peace. In related news, the United Nations and aid agencies protested Israel's attempt to close off Gaza to everyone from entering or leaving except diplomats and journalists. Oxfam, Doctors Without Borders, and the World Food Program said the move is preventing aid from reaching Gaza, and that's in violation of international law. Two Palestinian journalists, one of whom works for French public television, said today they had been beaten up by Israeli soldiers in the West Bank town of Bethlehem. This according to Agence France-Presse. In a meeting with Philippines President Arroyo, President Bush announced yesterday the U.S. will increase its aid to the Philippines in its fight in the so-called war on terror. The U.S. is expected to supply $95 million and an estimated 700 troops. The Washington Post reports, under the agreement, the U.S. will provide substantial training assistance to Philippine units engaged in combat operations against the Abu Sayyaf group. United Nations officials are investigating the killing of two UN observers in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The two UN observers, a Nigerian and a Jordanian, were part of a UN team of military observers sent to monitor ceasefire agreements aimed at ending the Congo war. Their bodies were exhumed from a makeshift grave this weekend near the gold mining town of Mongbalu. The UN Security Council has approved the deployment of an international force to stop escalating bloodshed in the northeastern part of Congo, where 50,000 people have died. The London Observer's reporting U.S. troops have vandalized the Sumerian city of Ur in southern Iraq, which may be the world's most ancient structure. Aid workers have said U.S. forces spray-painted the remains with graffiti and stole kiln-baked bricks made millennia ago. As a result, the U.S. military has put the archaeological treasure, which dates back 6,000 years, off limits to its own troops. Ur is believed by many to be the birthplace of the prophet Abraham. It was the religious seat of the civilization of Sumer, which ruled Mesopotamia starting about 4000 BC. It was there that the wheel was invented, the first mathematical system developed, and the first poetry written. 59 gang members who were killed in a Honduras prison were the victims of a police massacre, according to an independent report commissioned by the Honduran president. The police initially reported the prisoners died after setting a suicide fire in the jail. The report says 51 of the dead were shot, stabbed, beaten, or burned to death by a force of state police, soldiers, prison guards, and prisoners working with the guards. According to the New York Times, the victims were members of a youth group called the Mara 18, an offshoot of the Los Angeles-based 18th Street Gang. The report reveals the wretched state of Honduras's prisons. On the day of the massacre, the prison, El Porvenir, held close to 550 men, 350 more than its capacity. A police sergeant at the prison said the arrival of 80 gang members in February turned the prison into a time bomb. The U.S. Supreme Court has upheld a drug cost program in the state of Maine that penalizes pharmaceutical companies that refuse to provide affordable prescription drugs to poor citizens. The 6-3 ruling may have important implications for the increasing amount of Americans whose health care is threatened by the rising cost of prescription drugs. They are either not poor enough to qualify for Medicaid or are covered by private plans that do not cover many prescriptions. Several other states are expected to take the ruling as a go-ahead to adopt similar prescription drug programs. A new report by the Congressional Research Service has determined that U.S. gun laws can be easily exploited by international terror groups who can obtain assault-style firearms or explosives by taking advantage of delays and loopholes in the federal gun control system. This, according to a report in the Washington Post. Democratic Senator Frank Lautenberg lashed out at the Bush administration for failing to strengthen gun laws after September 11th. Lautenberg said, after 9-1-1, Americans stood in long lines at airports giving up their toenail clippers, while the Bush administration has done nothing to prevent terrorists from acquiring military-style weapons and explosives. If we are serious about shoring up homeland security, Lautenberg said, we cannot ignore this any longer. The study also notes Attorney General John Ashcroft has advocated destroying gun records immediately after a legal purchase rather than retaining them for audit purposes. He also forbade the FBI from searching purchase records for suspects after the September 11th attacks. Ashcroft has said in both cases he was seeking to uphold the Brady Act, which created the system. This just in, the U.S. Embassy in Saudi Arabia will close some offices in the kingdom on Wednesday, citing fears of further attacks after deadly suicide bombings in Riyadh last week. U.S. and Saudi officials blamed the attack on al-Qaeda. The bombings killed 34 people. Meanwhile, a bomb blast in Ankara killed one person and injured another. Turkish authorities are investigating whether it was a suicide attack. This news from Florida, a man who drove his truck into a mosque and yelled anti-Muslim threats has been sentenced to more than 2 years in prison. The man, Charles Franklin, pled guilty to hate crimes in November. He could have been sentenced to up to 20 years in prison. Instead, he received the minimum sentence. And at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, 1 in 8 graduates walked out of a commencement speech by Senator Rick Santorum to protest his remarks against homosexuality. Santorum, the Senate's third-ranking Republican, has refused to apologize for remarks he made last month comparing homosexuality to incest, bigamy, polygamy, and adultery. The Pentagon is developing a radar-based device that can identify people by the way they walk for use in a massive surveillance program, this according to the Associated Press. The Georgia Institute of Technology says it has created a system that is 80 to 95% successful in identifying people by their gait. AP reports the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, could use the ID system to be part of a vast surveillance system alongside databases containing financial, education, medical, and housing records, as well as biometric identification databases based on fingerprints, irises, and facial shapes. And if they don't get you walking, they'll get you sitting. The New York Daily News is reporting that New York police have ticketed a 19-year-old man for simply sitting on a milk crate. The man, Jesse Tavares, was given a ticket Sunday that read, quote, unauthorized use of a milk crate. He was sitting in front of a hair braiding salon in the Bronx where he works. Police approached him. He was asked for ID and then checked if he had any outstanding warrants. He did not. Then he was issued a summons. The police officer told him why, quote, because you're sitting. We have to make our daily quota.
As I raise my hand to broadcast my objection to latest triumph draws the final straw. Who died and lifted you up to perfection? And what silenced me is written into law. I can't believe where circumstances thrown me. I turn my head away. If I look, I'm not sure that I could face you. Not again. Not today. Not today. If hatred makes a play on me tomorrow, then forgiveness take a backseat to a hurt down deep that has not been corrected. There's a voice in me that says you will not win. And if I ignore the person inside, raise a half glass to my home. But it's there that I am most afraid. It doesn't hold, it doesn't hold. Now I don't believe that I never did the two wrongs make a right. If the world were filled with the likes of you that I've put up a fight, putting up a fight, putting up a fight.
It's the final straw, REM, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Wisconsin Democratic Senator Russell Feingold yesterday called on the Federal Communications Commission's chair to postpone a vote on loosening rules on media ownership. But FCC Chair Michael Powell turned down a similar request from two Democratic FCC commissioners last week. The FCC is poised to vote on the proposal to relax the rules on June 2nd. The rules have not even been made public. Still, some things are known about the upcoming vote. Under the expected changes, for the first time ever, broadcasters will be allowed to own television stations that reach more than 35% of the country. They will be allowed to own a newspaper and broadcast outlet in the same market. And the four largest TV networks will be free to merge. That means a single CEO could theoretically own all the largest media outlets in the country. Analysts say if the revised rules are passed, the U.S. will see a wave of media mergers and consolidation that is unprecedented in U.S. history. Major media conglomerates such as AOL Time Warner, General Electric, Disney, and Viacom, and Rupert Murdoch's News Corp are all lobbying for the changes. We're joined right now by Frank Blethyn. He is publisher of the Seattle Times and five other papers in Washington and Maine. He's been a vocal opponent of the proposed FCC changes to the media ownership regulations. And we're also joined by Sean Sheehan, who is a lobbyist for the Tribune Company. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Frank Blethyn of the Seattle Times, why are you opposed to the relaxing of media ownership rules?
Well, it's pretty simple. We have already had a really frightening monopolization of America's media, starting with newspapers, through all the electronic and through all the methods of distribution. And we are on the verge of having all of our media and all of our distribution controlled not only by a handful of small, powerful corporations, but corporations which ultimately are now being more increasingly controlled by Wall Street and essentially faceless financial investors whose only fiduciary responsibility is stock prices and short-term earnings, which drives out the journalism, the local connection, and the public service, which essentially our democracy is based on. It says something that there are only 280 independent newspapers left in the country. Most are very small. There's only about six of the size of the Seattle Times. And there is such a chill already on this because of the conglomerate media control that I'm literally the only publisher in the country that's independent and willing to speak out on it. And you don't hardly hear any working journalist speak out on it because they're afraid of job security, though I would note that increasingly we're seeing some brave souls like the TV critic at the LA Times, which is a Tribune company, who wrote a wonderful column yesterday. But if the FCC is allowed to do this, we really are in trouble with democracy. And the Pew Center did a study recently that found that something like 72% of Americans don't have a clue what the FCC is up to, nor do they really understand the media conglomeration. And that we found that that's true on Capitol Hill also. And the reason is this has been a complete insider game. It's been media lobbyists and media moguls in a very friendly relationship with the FCC staff. It has not received media scrutiny. It's not received public scrutiny. And now that it's finally being drug out for some public scrutiny, you know, the supposed arguments they put forth just simply don't hold water. I mean, we're talking newspapers that brag about a 30% profit margin and companies that brag about their TV stations having 45 and 50% profit margins, claiming that they need more monopolization and more concentration so they can compete. You know, and I think the question is, compete with who? Compete with each other for the attention of financial investors in Wall Street? Certainly not for the benefit of the public.
Sean Sheehan, you're a lobbyist for the Tribune Company. Your response to...
First off, the newspaper ban was put in place in 1975. I think your lead into the story didn't have that quite correct. Therefore, there remain several situations in which newspapers and broadcast properties in the same market have the same ownership. We, of course, in Chicago with WGN and the Chicago Tribune would be a prime example. But you've also got WSB in Atlanta, Georgia, the Atlanta Constitution, which is the Cox Company. Below in Dallas. Now, the curious part, and that's the Dallas Morning News and WFAA television in Dallas, and the point being that these stations and newspapers have long exemplary records, not only in journalism, but as citizens in their communities. The rule was adopted in 1975 because the theory was there's a small amount of electronic media that could be apportioned out, and disparate ownership would help the robust marketplace of ideas. Very worthy cause, I might add. But even in adopting the rule way back when, the FCC established that these stations were owned by newspaper companies, broadcast more news and public affairs than any other category of ownership. Further, they could establish absolutely no harm. So it's kind of interesting. You had a theory that overrode what was really happening in markets nationwide. Now, you go forward from 1975 to the present, and what we've seen is an enormous growth in the outlets of media. Back in 75, there were less than 1,000 TV stations nationwide. Most markets had ABC, NBC, CBS. That was it. Maybe an independent in the major markets. Now, of course, we're up to about 4,000 TV stations. There was very little cable. And now we're over 80 million homes with cable. Nearly another 20% of the country has satellite reception. The Internet had never been thought of. FM radio was in its infancy, on and on and on. You've had an explosion of media. The only element of media that's gone down in raw numbers is newspapers. In 1996, major telecommunications legislation
was passed, and it requires the FCC to look at all its broadcast rules, its ownership rules, on a biennial basis, with the onus on the FCC to justify why these rules should stay in place. Because the Congress, and I think correctly so in 96, decided that the migration away from the free broadcast media to pay is not a healthy societal outcome. And we need to factor ways to allow the broadcasters to gain scale so they can better compete with cable. And that's really what this is all about. The FCC is not lone gunning this, if you will. They have to look at these rules on every 2 years. And quite frankly, the only rule that hasn't been dealt with to date is the newspaper ban, which is what Frank and I are talking about. And get ready for this ruling on June 2, the FCC went into the field and conducted 14 independent surveys. They came up with essentially the same findings they had back in 75, that the existing station newspaper combinations, once again, are putting on more news and more public affairs than any other category of ownership, nor can they find any harm. Well, given the requirement of the 96 Act that the Commission must act, and given the fact that the onus is on the FCC to defend why the rules should stay in place, given the records of these combinations and the great growth of cable and satellite and else, I think it argues rather persuasively that newspapers and broadcasters in local markets should be allowed to have common ownership.
Frank Blethyn of the Seattle Times, your response.
Yeah, I mean, the arguments, you're very articulate, but the arguments are the ones that continually be put forth by the media companies. Let me just sort of tick off the highlights. First of all, the FCC field studies are very questionable. People who are steeped in academic research have started taking a look at them. This is all part of the process where they haven't had enough time or enough openness to even vet the stuff that they put out there. They're very questionable, both studies. Secondly, the FCC chairman brags about receiving somewhere between 18 and 20,000 electronic comments about this process. What he fails to tell you in the same breath is that something like 95% of them are all against any more relaxing of the rules or any more concentration of ownership. One of the main arguments put forth is this explosion of media, and usually internet and cable is cited. Well, it's not explosion of media. It's explosion of access points, and it's explosion of people reusing information that's already out there. You know, 100 channels of cable is about 95 channels of junk that you don't watch. And the internet, anything credible on the internet is generally coming from already existing news sources, usually newspapers. And the fact of the matter is, and it's internet and cable that they generally cite, the fact of the matter is they've already monopolized cable. There's only about three primary owners, and they've already monopolized the main web news sites that are visited. So there's been an explosion of access points, but in terms of original news, newsrooms, and having any kind of a local connection, we're losing our local connection throughout the country. And in fact, it's interesting because if you read Howard Rosenberg's column, television column, in the LA Times yesterday, which is now a Tribune newspaper, he basically repeats what I'm saying, but gives really good examples about what's wrong with conglomerate TV ownership in his own hometown market.
Sean Sheehan.
Well, first off, in order to compete against a plethora of channels, and in fact, when these rules were put on way back when, CNN didn't exist, MSNBC didn't exist, on and on and on. So I think that belies the notion that these aren't new and different sources. But quite frankly, strategically, the only way my local newspapers and local TV stations can compete against the influx of signals coming from afar is to examine the local market and to report on the local market. In other words, that's what differentiates my signal and my properties away from the national signals. So I don't think it's accurate to say that there's a walk away from local news coverage, because that's what makes me vital. And the simple point is, and Frank knows this, is the ability to amass
local news coverage from a major market newspaper is a very expensive enterprise. Quite frankly, Yahoo and all the other services simply aren't going to cover the local school boards, the local municipalities. Only your big city newspaper does it. And what we're attempting to do is not to just think of ourselves as ink on paper. We're trying to reach our audience in the ways they want to be reached and to keep this kind of robust local dialogue healthy. Clearly, with circulation figures are down nationwide, they have been for years and years and years, I think we need to see, we've got to try to factor why youngsters aren't reading and try to get the information to them the way they want to receive it.
Frank Blethyn, you're a publisher, Seattle Times. Why aren't you concerned about circulation numbers being down?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. Let me respond to the local news. I would just ask your viewers to consider the last time they watched their local telecast, whatever city they're in, whatever size, and how much local news was on it. With the conglomeratization and the monopolization of television, the further relaxing of the FCC rules, what we have seen is local television news is an absolute wasteland. And again, I'd refer people to Howard Rosenberg's column yesterday in the LA Times, which refers to this. The circulation figures is really a good example, because my industry, when I started my career 35 years ago, there were about 1,700 papers, most of them locally or regionally connected. Today, there's about 1,500, and as I said, only about 280, mostly small, are still local and independent. As the public ownership started, and the Gannett Company was sort of the forerunner of this, but as public ownership, Wall Street control of newspapers started about 30 years ago, what we saw was a disinvestment in news and editorial and marketing and service. In the early 90s, when we had the small recession, newspaper analyst John Morton used to write about the public companies eating their corn seed. And what he meant by that is they were cutting news holes, they were laying off news people, and they were providing crappy delivery service. And in going into this recession, that scenario repeated itself. You know, these publishers go to the newspaper association meeting, wringing their hands over circulation, and what they're going to do about it. And yet, it's increased pricing, it's less content, smaller newsrooms, and bad service. You look at places like the Seattle Times and the handful of independent papers, and there are some small public chains that still have family influence like McClatchy or even the New York Times or Washington Post, and we have a different story to tell. We have circulation growth in spite of the recession. The Seattle Times has probably, best as we can determine, the highest 18 to 24-year-old readership in the country. Young people are reading. They're reading lots of stuff. We just have to make sure newspapers are more compelling and not disinvested.
Well, we have to break up the discussion at this point, but it's certainly one we're going to continue. Democracy Now! Will be going down to the hearing in Atlanta tomorrow that FCC Commissioner Adelstein is holding, and then we will continue to follow the whole issue of media consolidation through June 2nd, if in fact that is the date that the FCC votes. Though many are calling for that date to be postponed. Frank Blethyn, publisher of the Seattle Times, and Sean Sheehan, a lobbyist for the Tribune Company. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Now we're hoping that this war won't spread beyond the current state that it is.
Baghdad Radio says Saddam Hussein braved Allied bombs to visit his troops in Kuwait. The Allies are hitting elite Iraqi troops with all their power.
With George Bush, who says he loved peace, has led the nation into war.
Why are we in this war?
1991 has begun, and money's 21 now. I don't know, somehow picking up a gun now, loaded with gunpowder, fighting for the system's wrong. The black's down now, before we used to diss them.
Of this nation, we make up 12%. The front line seems to misrepresent, cause I hear that they're working more than 30% of color there, fighting for some oil, but you think we'll ever get a share?
So don't gas me to go and get gas in the worst way. I'm the first to say pass, G, and don't think that you're taking me by sending me a draft card. Oh, you're making me laugh hard. So ran
rave, cause I know. Time for Peace by Paris here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The BBC producer who had his foot amputated after stepping on a landmine in Iraq has called on news organizations to continue using independent journalists in war zones despite the risks. Stuart Hughes was part of a four-person team filming the invasion of Iraq in Kurdish-held territory. A local guide accidentally brought them into a minefield. In the explosion, Stuart's colleague, Kaveh Golestan, the Iranian cameraman and photographer, was killed. 13 reporters, cameramen, and other media workers lost their lives in Iraq. Hughes told the London Guardian, and it was a terrible war for journalists. But he is still insisting on the importance of independent journalism. He said, "We will always need people on the ground, independently forging ahead, finding the stories." He warned the deaths of journalists may be used as an excuse to push aside independent journalists in favor of embedding journalists with the military. Last night, media critic Robert Jensen spoke at St. Francis College in Brooklyn on the U.S. coverage of the invasion of Iraq. Robert Jensen is associate professor at the University of Texas School of Journalism in Austin, and he is the author of Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream. Robert Jensen.
I think on the question of the widest range of possible opinion, for reasons Molly already explained, we don't need to spend a lot of time on that one. If you look at television news, understanding that the vast majority of Americans get the vast majority of their news from television, and that's only intensifying, that the range of opinion, as the joke always goes, was roughly from A to B. You had current government officials balanced with retired government officials. You had current generals, you know the story. If you've watched television, that one is not hard to understand. So the widest range of opinion was not present in the American media. I also think the historical political context that we need to understand what's going on also was sadly lacking. But I also think that some of the independent factual information we need, just the basic facts, was also often absent or distorted. So what I want to do is use the framework of, it's a tired old journalist framework of the five W's and the H. Right? Who, what, why, where, when, and how. If you take a beginning journalism class, I think I got this first when I was 15 years old, you wanted to make sure you got the five W's and the H in every story. So I thought this is a, since it's the sort of the canon of journalism, right? Let's use it to evaluate how well the contemporary mainstream media did in that project. I'm going to take them slightly out of order, but let's start with when. I would contend that the American news media got the when wrong, right? I mean, they knew a war was going on in Iraq, and they were there, and they got I'm not saying the datelines on the stories were wrong. They were right, right? March 19th, March 20th. But this was always referred to in the U.S. media as a war that began on March 19th. I think that was a fundamental mistake, because the war against Iraq, of course, has been going on since 1991, right? The war against Iraq never ended. After the cessation of hostilities in 1991, the economic embargo on Iraq remained in place, and I'm sure many of you know about the consequences of that, the harshest economic embargo that's been placed on a nation in modern history. Estimates vary from 500,000 to 1 million civilian Iraqis killed as a direct result of those economic sanctions. In 1998, Bill Clinton bombed Iraq in Operation Desert Fox. You may remember a cruise missile strike. And after that, there was regular bombing in the so-called no-fly zones, which were often portrayed in the U.S. news media as UN-sanctioned no-fly zones. Minor problem, the UN never sanctioned them. But that's a war that was going on, an economic war and a low-level military campaign that never ended. So the media, I think, got the when wrong when they talked about the war starting in March of 2003. It had been going on for many, many years prior to that. I think they got the who wrong as well. Basic fact, who was fighting? Well, this is might seem like a minor point, but I think it's a very important point. Almost all of the American mainstream news media used the term that came out of the Pentagon and the White House. You remember this term? Coalition forces. Who was doing the fighting? Coalition forces. The coalition of the willing. The largest coalition ever put together in modern history, according to George W. Bush. He had a list of, I don't know, 49, 62, you know, it varied. The only problem with most of the coalition nations is they didn't do anything as part of the coalition. It was like signing a petition almost, right? Their names were there, but they didn't do anything. The coalition, of course, was simply the United States and its favorite attack dog, Great Britain, which is still a separate nation, as far as I can tell, although Prime Minister Tony Blair maybe is taking them into the 50. You know, it's always a question, who's going to be the 51st state? Puerto Rico, you know, who knows? Maybe it's going to be Great Britain, you never know. All right, so there was no coalition. And anyone who had any independent knowledge knew this was a farce. But day after day, on television, the newspapers, today coalition forces moved into the desert. And if you repeat that long enough, you know, people who don't spend all of their time online trying to figure out what's really going on say, oh, coalition, UN, it must be legitimate, right? It's a very subtle way of avoiding a very simple question, which is, did the United States have authorization under international law to go into this? So they got the who wrong as well, I think. Well, let's move on to the what. What was the Iraq War? Okay. I think they got that one wrong, too, for the simple reason it wasn't really a war. I mean, I think we all understand this, at least those of us here probably do. You know, the standard interpretation of a war, it's sort of when two sides shoot at each other, and that really didn't happen. It was quite striking that there was talk of the brilliant American military campaign to defeat Iraq. Right, you have a country which has no control over its own airspace and no viable air force. It has a very weakened conscript army that's under-trained, underfunded, it has no sophisticated equipment left. Right? And you defeat that with the most powerful military force that's ever existed in the world, with unlimited funds and an incredibly better trained and better equipped army. Okay, that's a great military victory. Right? It wasn't really a war. It was an invasion, that's true, but it was rarely called that in the American press. It was, of course, often referred to by the name the Pentagon gave it, Operation Iraqi Freedom, the emphasis on the liberation. And I do think we should be realistic. In fact, it was, in some sense, a liberation. The regime of Saddam Hussein was one of the most brutal on the planet, one of the last truly totalitarian states. And the fact that Saddam Hussein is gone, I can't speak for the Iraqi people, but personally, if I were an Iraqi, I would be very happy about that. I'm not sure I'd be so happy about what might be down the road. But it did have that character of liberating a people. But it was also an invasion. It was also an illegal invasion, not sanctioned under international law. The United States news media never conveyed the complexity of that. It was simply Operation Iraqi Freedom, to the point where at least two of the cable news networks, MSNBC and Fox, actually used that logo on the bottom of the screen or up in the top, which is the closest thing you can then become to being a kind of wholly owned subsidiary of the Pentagon. So they got the when wrong, they got the who wrong, they got the what wrong, and I think we might look at the why and come to a similar conclusion. Why did we go to war? Well, of course, in addition to our great desire to liberate the Iraqi people that we'd been bludgeoning with the worst economic embargo in history for 12 years, there were two other reasons stated about why we went to war: weapons of mass destruction and Iraq terrorist ties. And I suspect a lot of you here tonight know the story on this. The connections between Iraq and Al-Qaeda or other terrorist nations or terrorist groups was, of course, never proven. The Bush administration would routinely float stories that turned out to be false to try and create the impression in the minds of the American public that, in fact, there was some connection between Saddam Hussein's regime and terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda. These were effective enough propaganda techniques that at one point before the war, a poll showed that 42% of the American public thought that Saddam Hussein had been directly involved in 9/11. Okay. Well, I think even the Bush administration at some point kind of gave up trying to make that claim. So we can kind of discard terrorist ties in part because the Bush administration discarded it itself, except in a very subtle and nefarious way. Well, the weapons of mass destruction story is now pretty clear. We're more than a month past the operation. The current count of either weapons of mass destruction or substantive weapons of mass destruction programs found, the last time I checked, was, zero, okay? There was a very pithy question asked in a briefing, one of the Central Command briefings. A journalist got up and said, "Now that the war is over and there have been no weapons of mass destruction found, will this be the first war that was over before the reason for it existed?" One footnote, it was not an American reporter who asked that question. It was a British reporter, again echoing something Molly said about the way in which this war was covered very differently depending on what country the journalist came from. Okay. So we've gone through the when, the who, the what, the why. The why, of course, we can talk in more detail. The real why, I think, is quite different than what the Bush administration offered. The real why was, of course, about the extension, the deepening of American power in that strategically crucial region. In other words, as some people were saying during the war, this is a war about empire and oil, not about weapons of mass destruction and terrorism. I also think they got the how wrong. How did we win this war? Well, of course, this is another case where if you compare American news coverage to news coverage anywhere else, and not just in the Arab world, this is often framed as the way the American media and the way the Arab media, the way it showed up on CNN, the way it showed up on Al Jazeera. But it didn't break down like that. It broke down to the way it showed up on the American news media and the way it showed up in the rest of the world, okay? It was that stark a choice. And the how was very different. In the United States, the American news media, again, especially television, gave us an image of precision weapons, laser-guided munitions, a fighting force that was using the latest technology to reduce civilian casualties. And I do think we should acknowledge that compared to the 1991 Gulf War, civilian casualties were extremely low in this war. Right? The devastation of the Gulf War was horrendous by any definition, and this was a much milder war, if you'll accept that kind of perhaps obscene terminology to talk about war. But what we didn't, because the frame was always civilian casualties, we didn't hear much about how the war was fought in general. And the fact that the war was extremely brutal, if you include in your conception of who we might want to evaluate, what we might want to evaluate, is the way it was fought against Iraqi troops. It was a real slaughter in a lot of cases. Iraqi troops that were not under any sometimes apparent command, coming in waves and being mowed down by all this sophisticated American weaponry. There was a very interesting story, it's a bit of a footnote, in the Christian Science Monitor, which is, as newspapers went, did some of the best reporting, I think, on the war. And the reporter interviewed a young man, private perhaps, in the army, who had been in one of these battles where the Iraqi soldiers just kept coming, and he kept mowing them down with his machine guns. And he, you know, as a human being, was having a struggle with this, as I think is appropriate. He was saying, you know, I can't help but wonder now if this was all worth it. Did we really, he said, we slaughtered a lot of people. And is it worth it? What were we here for? He was engaging in what I would call a very important sort of moral self-reflection. About a week after that story appeared, Tommy Franks, the commanding general, was being interviewed on ABC. And the interviewer, who was not grilling Tommy, you know, he was handing him a series of softball questions, cited the Christian Science Monitor story and said, "General Franks, if this soldier were in front of you right now, right, here's a young man going through this kind of questioning, what would you say to him?" And the supreme allied coalition commander in the theater of war sort of meandered a bit around the question. And finally, the best he could come up with was he said, "I would tell that soldier, son, you did your duty and your country is proud of you." Right? I think that was a very powerful moment for me that a 19-year-old private on top of a tank in the desert can exhibit more moral self-reflection and humanity than the commanding general. I think there's something important in that. Okay. Back to the how. There were lower civilian casualties. There was more use of precision weaponry, but that precision weaponry also did kill people. And the United States public didn't see much of the killing people part of it, as has been common in previous coverage. Another thing that I think is interesting about the how is you might remember back to early in the war when a number of the Iraqi troops shed their uniforms, dressed in civilian clothing, and engaged in traditional guerrilla-style tactics. For a while, that was being called terrorist-style tactics by the news media. It was first, of course, came out of the mouths of the Pentagon briefers, and the media picked it up for a while. I think they realized the inappropriateness of it later, but they did use that. Right? And that was very powerful because here you have an invading army without international sanction going into a country and attacking. And the people there had the nerve to fight back with whatever means they had available, which at one point became guerrilla tactics. Can you imagine the nerve of these people? To dare to try to repel an invading army by shedding their uniforms, that's not fighting fair. But of course, the importance of terrorist-style tactics is to identify whoever is fighting back against America in any context as a terrorist. Now, terrorism, the common definition of terrorism, and I think it's a sensible one, is that terrorism is the use of violence or threats of violence against a civilian population to achieve political purposes. To the best of my knowledge, those Iraqi troops were not firing on American civilians. They were firing on American troops. The use of the term terrorism was completely inappropriate and inaccurate. But that, again, small things like these terms really do have an effect, especially on a population that's been bludgeoned by propaganda like this since 9/11. All right. When I was going through this and sketching my notes for this, I thought, well, okay, we did when, who, what, why, how. Those they all got wrong. But I figured, you know, at least they got the where right. Right? Once they got over there, they realized they were in Iraq and the date lines were all correct, you know. And then I started thinking, you know, they really got the where wrong, too. Because this was all framed as a war against Iraq. And I think what I came to think is that that was probably the most important error. Because this really wasn't just a war against Iraq. This was a war against Iran, against Syria, and ultimately a war against China. Not a direct attack on these countries, of course, but a message to those countries, a message to the whole world, of course, that this is what happens if you defy American power. But if one believes the analysis that the folks in the Bush White House really see the end game as China, containing China, right? China has the fastest growing economy in the world. It's the only credible threat to the U.S., and that's where they're looking. Then I think they got the where wrong. This wasn't a war. It was a war that took place in Iraq, but it wasn't all about Iraq. And I think that's one of the most fundamental failures of the media, to put this war into the context so we could see where the real targets were. All right. That's a run-through of some of what I think are the most obvious failures of the news media during this. What I want to spend a little time with to wrap up is talking specifically about the embedded reporter system and how this came to be. Because I think there's a very important lesson in the embedded reporter system. To talk about it, I'll do a little bit of history, which may be familiar to many of you, but I'll run through quickly. Remember that after Vietnam, I think the American military had a mistaken impression of the role of the press in Vietnam, but their impression was that the press had been counterproductive to the military's goals. Okay. I think if you look at the history of press coverage of Vietnam, it's much more complex. The media, at least up until 1968, were very pro-war for the most part, but facts aside, this is about the perception of the military. You had to control the press better than they had done in Vietnam. And, of course, in the important American victory over Grenada, remember Grenada in 1983? At that time, the dagger pointed at the heart of America. And then the American invasion of Panama in 1989. The U.S. government, the U.S. Defense Department, was perfecting systems of control. Right, and they were getting into a bit of a row with the journalists. There was conflict. And in 1991, in the Gulf War, they came up with an incredibly efficient system, which was a kind of combination of It was a good cop, bad cop kind of game the Pentagon played. The bad cop side was press pools, right? We're going to keep you contained. Few representatives go out in the field, highly constrained by Pentagon minders with strict censorship. Okay, that was the bad cop part. The good cop part was, but we're also going to have this briefing room in Riyadh where we're going to show up with General Schwarzkopf, you know, Storm and Norman, he's very charismatic, lots of other generals, right? And we're going to give you everything you need. We're going to give you briefings. We're going to give you video footage of smart bombs hitting targets. We're going to constrain you over here, but we're going to feed you over here, right? So they penned up the media in one sense and then threw them a lot of raw meat. Here's some, you know, here's some steaks. Go feed on it. And for the most part, the media were happy, the mainstream commercial, especially television, because they did get what they needed to fill the time. But there were still problems. The media were, you know, resistant to this kind of direct control. And so the Pentagon had to rethink their strategy, partly because of that conflict with media, but also partly because they realized, and they've said this openly, that by restricting the media so much, some of the kind of war coverage that they like, right, which is stories of the grunts in the trenches, the stories of the march of the American military forward, some of those stories they like, kind of World War II style stories about the successes of the military, they didn't get because they'd kept the journalists out, and they started thinking maybe we want some of that. The other thing that's very important is the technology changed between 91 and 2003. Video phones, satellite phones, all this sort of thing made reporting from the field much easier for journalists. And at the same time, you had the rise of the Arab media. You had Al Jazeera on the scene. And they knew that however much they could control American reporters, they were not going to be able to control the Arabic language press. And so the Pentagon, I think, made a very smart decision. They decided to create this embedded reporting system. Whoever came up with it in the Pentagon should get a doubled salary and a promotion. It's brilliant. As a public relations propaganda campaign, it is absolutely brilliant. And it's a... Pardon? She was part of it, right? So she may be our next White House press secretary, now the tragic loss of Ari Fleischer, who wants to spend more time with his family. I felt like calling Ari and say, Ari, I'll spend more time with your family. You stay in the White House. It's too much fun having you there. So it was a very, very successful system. And I think that the lesson to learn from, I'm going to talk a bit about why I think it was so successful, but the lesson to learn from it is these people in places like the Pentagon and the White House, they may seem kind of crazy to us, irrational, power hungry, you know, madmen, but they're very good at what they do. And as we get better, as the press gets smarter, as movements get smarter, they react. They find new ways to control, and it's a very important lesson. So how did this embedded system control reporters? Because it is true that roughly 600 reporters traveled with various American military units during this war. Well, there were a couple of reasons why that really wasn't a threat to the Pentagon's control over information. The first and most important is all of those embedded reporters signed a contract with the military when they embedded. And one of the components of that contract was they agreed to never acquire independent transportation. To be an embedded reporter meant you traveled with this unit, and if you went out and you couldn't go up to the commander and say, hey, listen, you know, I hired a Jeep and a translator. I'm going to go out on my own for a couple of days. Right? That wasn't in the rules. You did that, you were gone. Okay? So you had... reporters completely dependent on the military for movement. Not only for movement, of course, but for food and protection and everything. Okay. Well, that's going to have an obvious effect. It's going to constrain the ability of reporters to move outside of the military's purview. In addition, censorship was not exercised in very many cases, but it was always held in reserve. If you read the Defense Department guidelines, they talked about reserving the right to censor for operational security matters. Okay, operational security is one of those terms that gets very broad when they need it to. The point is they didn't need to do it. The war went so quickly and it went so well, they never really had to. And the media stayed in line. But we shouldn't be fooled that they had given up their right to censor. We know perfectly well, I think, that if conditions had changed, they would have used that power. The fact is that these embedded reporters, as everyone predicted, became sort of bonded to their units, right? They became sort of one of the boys. And most of the reporting from those embedded reporters reflects that. You really had two kinds of stories in general. There were exceptions, but in general, you had stories about what the troops, what life for the troops was like, right? Like, how many of you don't know that when you can't take a shower in the desert, you clean up with baby wipes? And we heard the baby wipe. Well, you know, I'm here in the desert and I had to clean up with baby wipes. Thank you. God, thank God for embedded reporters to tell me that when you don't have a shower in the desert, you get to use baby wipes. I mean, that was the kind of stuff we were hearing over and over again. Stories about what it was like, what the troops were doing, how they were keeping the morale up. And I don't want to be flippant about this. If you have friends and loved ones in the theater of battle, I'm sure it's very heartening, right? But that's not news in an important sense. The other thing that the embedded reporters tend to send back was really narrating the great advance of the American military machine, right? I mean, literally narrating. The first time I saw this was an NBC reporter, actually the NBC reporter who later died of an embolism, but he was on top of an armored vehicle moving across the desert in real time, sending a signal back to New York, talking to Tom Brokaw on the desk, and I'm sitting in Austin, Texas, watching all of this. That was pretty amazing, right? There, I mean, it was fun. That never happened before. Never had we seen a war in real time like that. The problem is, we didn't see anything. We saw armored vehicles going across the desert. That's news in some vague sense of it. It wasn't anything that ever helped people understand the war. Most of what the embedded reporters sent back, I would argue, did very little to help people understand what the war was about.
Right. Robert Jensen, he is a professor at University of Texas at Austin, and author of Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream. And that does it for the show. Our website is democracynow.org. Our email address is mail@democracynow.org. If you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Rival and Volkert Souris. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, with help from Rich Kim. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
George Bush, who says he loves peace, has led the nation into war.
Why are we in this war?
1991 has begun, and money's 21 now. I don't know, somehow picking up... A-